we're here to talk about Damon Runyon, his life, and you, of course, wrote about his times as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I, last night I was watching A Lady for a Day. That's the title, Lady for a Day?
Yeah.
I watched it, unfortunately, when I taped it a couple of weeks ago. But I wanted to kind of get in the mood when I came in to watch that. I have five Damon Runyon movies on tape, and that was one I wanted to watch, and I just, for some reason, I didn't set the timer on the VCR just right. I taped it from American Movie Classics, and I lost the last, must be the last 2 minutes. So I know what's going to happen, because the mayor just walked, and I know you know the movie. The mayor walks in, and they're in the, I guess, in the ballroom. But I want to find out exactly what happened. So,
you'll have to go back.
Lucky thing about American Movie Classics is that they repeat them and repeat them and repeat them. So I'll retake it. But I think here we are in 1991, and Damon Runyon is a man of the 20s, 30s, 40s. I think a lot of people don't know the name Damon Runyon. So why don't we start with my asking you, who was Damon Runyon?
Who was he, and what am I doing writing about him? He was a... I'm writing because I was asked to write a book by a publisher about a man who was born in Manhattan, Kansas, went through Pueblo, Colorado, and Denver, Colorado, and was drinking whiskey in the tradition of the Old West and working in these newspapers. Then he proceeded to put down the glass and came east to New York City, where he got a job on the Hearst newspapers. That's a name out of the past, too. There's no Hearst newspaper in town, though. That's the, that is the newspaper chain that inspired the movie Citizen Kane, if we can get to the younger. He planted his size 5.5 B-feet on a street called Broadway, and he decided it was the greatest, most exciting street ever to be, because he was on it. He then began writing newspaper stories about sports and characters in New York, and began to compile, go into later on, as the years went by, he did short stories. He wrote 50 short stories, which was then the classic American form for fiction writers, serious writers. The short story was the big thing. You were competing, if you were a short story writer, with F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, John Dos Passos. They did short stories. Runyon did a work, he did 50 of them.
He did a lot for Cosmopolitan.
Yes, Cosmopolitan was a Hearst magazine. Then he did for the Saturday Evening Post. And
he did $5,000.
A shot.
You know, I just sold a short story. One of my short stories was accepted recently by a magazine, which is offering in payment three copies of it.
You're laughing. That's a tremendous thing. It's going to get printed, and who knows where it winds up. But in those days, they wanted the cash first before the honor of being published.
Can we go back a little bit?
26 of the, I just want to get the one thing. The impact on the city was made when 26 of those movies were made. Its short stories were made into movies. Some of them rather large American movies, such as the one you mentioned, Lady for a Day, and The Lemon Drop Kid with Bob Hope, and what was it, Little Miss Marker with Shirley Temple, and The Big Street, which is my favorite, which is Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda. It was my favorite movie she was in, she always said.
Not to mention Guys and Dolls.
And Guys and Dolls came after this. When Runyon died in 1946, after it, they gathered up his work, Cy Fuhr and Ernie Martin, the Broadway producers, and got Abe Burrows, and Frank Lesser wrote one of probably the only perfect score for a musical ever done. That's what everybody, Bob Fosse, always claimed. At any rate, it came out a thing called Guys and Dolls, which is going to be with us for all time. And that is the Runyon impact was that he invented Broadway. He made you believe, made everybody still believe that street existed with all its characters. He invented the Roaring Twenties. I mean, I come out of Ozone Park in Queens. The Roaring Twenties, it was as if there were no such thing as a Monday morning, if you read how these people wrote. Everybody's in the nightclubs dancing around with Nathan Detroit, and Miss Missouri Martin was another, was the woman, and they had all these showgirls and gangsters and crapshooters, and that's all life consisted of. Meanwhile, somebody's getting up on 134th Street in Ozone Park at 6:15 in the morning to catch the early bus to work, and can't you just hear them say, "Boy, I can't wait to join the Roaring Twenties again today." There were no other people. There was no such thing. People went to work. But he created this place and this illusion, and it lasted. It's in all of it. Go in any library. The Roaring Twenties is there. Broadway, the big street, the Great White Way, that's still there. The theater district, the Broadway of the theater district is separate from the Broadway Runyon claimed existed, was the sidewalk in front of Lindy's with all the characters on it. And it just didn't exist as a place. It was there, but not in the way they said it. And so any man can make an impact like that on the times in which he lived. I thought you ought to look at it. And in doing so, you got a very good look at the city of New York during those years. And you have an idea where you came from and what you lost in going from an era when you could live a life in illusion. And today we have to every day get up and stare hard at a reality which is painful to look at and to think about and to deal with.
Of course, the movies of the 20s, 30s, and 40s didn't also sustain that or reinforce that illusion, too. It was a fantasy world.
Oh, come on, and it was great. That's why I like doing the book. I'm tired of living in reality. I wanted to go into an illusion. These people are outrageously funny. And the lives were... Well, you take your... You mentioned you saw the movie Lady for a Date. Runyon had a young woman from... the first thing he was warned about on the sidewalk of this famous street he was inventing was by Enrico Caruso, the singer, who told him the only way you can get in trouble in New York, you could get stopped if you have the talent you have, is by young dolls. This is little dolls, little girls. They could stop anything. Now, the first thing Runyon did was go out and get a young woman who was 26 years younger than he was. She was up here from Juarez in Mexico. Now, he was living with a wife and two children. Now, you cannot leave your wife and two children for some commoner from Juarez, Mexico, but you can for a Spanish countess, which is what he decided his wife was, Patrice, the new wife. She became a Spanish countess. She had a 30-carat diamond, he insisted. The Amati, her last name he gave her was Amati, and that was the Amati diamond. It was the family diamond from Granada. They got an insurance guy that wanted to hang out with chorus girls, and he figured if he hung out with Runyon and Lindy's and that, they'd meet a lot of women. They got him to insure the thing, to certify it was there for $200,000. Everyone else on Broadway believed the ring was there. She was royalty. It was Runyon's wife. That's royalty. And, of course, you see the ring, you go blind when you see it. It's so big. And he left it. Then he wrote this story about it. Madame Le Gimp, which was based loosely on his own woman, Patrice Amati. Frank Capra turns it into a marvelous movie. Runyon sees it. He believes the whole thing. The illusion becomes reinforced by a movie. Now the two of them are walking around. She's a countess. He's married to a countess. Many years later, he became ill, and she left him. And of course, the young girl's going to leave the young guy, the old guy. That's for sure, and she left him for a younger guy. Runyon writes a letter, please don't rob this man of his youth. It's terrible of you to take away his years, his young years, which is what he did to the woman. Didn't bother him. He proceeds to die. She lives on south of Providence, Rhode Island, as a housekeeper she becomes, which is hard to...
You opened the book with the dinner party scene in which Patrice
is a housekeeper.
A housekeeper, but people imagine her as being more than that. This actually happened?
Actually happened. She thought a guy advertised for a housekeeper, and she showed up and she gave these references. One was Chase Manhattan Bank here in New York. And he found out, yes, it was Damon Runyon's widow, but she wanted to work, and this is what she wanted to do, take care of this large house south of Providence. The fellow's got a big beer distributorship he owns. And he was a widower. So she moved in and decided it was her house and that he was just somebody she could push around. And at dinner parties, she sat down with everybody. She hired somebody to do the work. And she was the lady of the house. Now comes, he got driven out of it for a holiday. You know, the guy in the house, he went away, and she's alone in the house, and two guys came and held her up because they had heard she had this Amati diamond. They hold her up, they take everything she's got, but they don't have the diamond. They don't know no diamond. They get arrested. And the lawyer in the trial, they went on trial for robbery, which they did do. They were guilty of an armed robbery, no question. The defense lawyer says to them, if we had the ring and could give it back, it would make it easier on everybody. At sentence time, you're going to get convicted. They said, we thought, the two thieves said, there was no ring. It's a dream. It was no ring. No, she's a liar. She took the witness stand and talked very convincingly about the Amati diamond that had been in her family for all those years from Granada. And as she talked, she believed what she was saying. She believed the diamond was there and had been stolen from her. The judge was Paul Kirk's father. Paul Kirk was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee just recently. Until recently, his father was the judge on the case. They're convicted, and they're sentenced, and went away. Patrice Amati, Damon Runyon's widow, collected $200,000 from the insurance company on a ring that never existed, yet she believed it existed. She went away with the $200,000, bought white chinchilla coats and a white Jaguar. The two fellas went to jail. And when they went to jail, they learned they were in trouble. The boss in Providence, Rhode Island, Raymond Patriarca, had asked, what is this ring they got that they didn't come and see me about it? I'm supposed to have a piece of this. Who are they? So they're in prison, which is bad enough, and they're afraid to come out because something worse will happen to them if they hit the streets. And it's the end of a Runyon story. It's just all illusion. It never happened, and yet everybody believes it, and everybody lives it.
Damon Runyon was born in Manhattan, Kansas. It's not unusual that people from Kansas want to go east or west. You're from Queens. I was born in Wichita, Kansas. I wanted to be a journalist, but the place that you fly your trade successfully is really in the east, in New York. But Runyon had quite a background in Colorado as a newspaper man long before he came to New York.
Had an entire life out there.
And a lot of the people, Pat Masterson was there.
Pat Masterson was a great... A lot of the characters that he put on Broadway in New York City that he claimed existed really came from his early years in Pueblo, which was a tough town, and the back alleys of Denver. He just, when he hit New York and he decided this is the greatest street in the world, he just started to put Pat Masterson on Broadway, who really did show up finally. And he put all these other fellas on Broadway, and there they were.
Pat Masterson did become a newspaper reporter here.
He was great. He's the best story around.
But in Guys and Dolls, he's known as Sky Masterson.
Pat Masterson was out in the West as a sheriff who never shot anybody, and he claimed he had killed half the people in the world and had the reputation of being a feared gunman and general brawler.
You're right about the badge that he keeps producing.
He had two fistfights that anybody could ever certify, and they were with Otto Flatto, the sports editor of the Denver Post. One was in Denver on a street corner in front of a cigar store, and everybody saw it. Neither participant landed a punch. They fought like senior citizens. And the other fight was in Pueblo, Colorado, where neither participant landed a punch. They couldn't fight. Now, Masterson promoted fights, and he promoted a fight involving fireman Jim Flynn out of Pueblo. He boxed somebody for 10 rounds. At the end of the fight, they came in to see Masterson in the back office to get paid, the fighter and his manager, and Masterson began to weep that it had been a very poor night for gate receipts. And all he could do was give them his fondest possession, and he took out this badge and showed he was the sheriff of Tombstone, Arizona. And they looked at it, and he said to the fighter, do you know where I wore that badge? And he said, the OK Corral, he told them, and I killed a lot of people, and don't you dare kill anybody while you have that badge. That badge is killed enough. Then the fighter took it and went out. He said, gee, imagine that. He gave me the thing closest to his heart. Boy, he really meant something. He meant it. I don't even miss the money he's not giving me. I'll keep this badge forever. And now the next fighter walked into the office. And as he walked in, Masterson is grimacing and saying, boy, we had a tough night at the gate, but I can do this. And into his pocket he went and came out with a second badge, of which he had 20 more, if there were 20 more people looking to get paid. He was a fraud. And when they chased him out of Denver, for cheating people. He got on a train and came to New York City, did Bat Masterson, the famous Masterson, and he engaged in a card game with a bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, a Mormon. And by the time they reached New York, the Mormon owed Masterson quite a bit of money for playing cards. And Masterson was on the corner of 69th Street and Columbus Avenue abusing the bishop and trying to get the money out of him when a good New York City Police Department officer grabbed Masterson, seeing him berating this obvious, shy, retiring man, clearly a church man, grabbed Masterson and took him to the police station, frisked him and found a gun. And he looked at the gun and it didn't even have a notch on it. So he said, this thing's never even been used. You're supposed to be a tough guy. Go on, get out of here. And he threw him out into the streets. And Masterson, with no way to intimidate people physically or using a gun in this great city, then turned to the only business that would support him at the time, and that was sports writing for a newspaper. When he went in, he couldn't spell, and his sentences weren't too good, but he had a lively imagination, so they liked him.
Of course, that's what Runyon was, a sports writer. And but he had dreams, of course, of being a fiction writer, which he really wanted to do. But the sports writer was an entree. Sports writer was an entree to the world of New York at that day.
That's
the gamblers,
right.
the gamblers and the singers and the dancers and all of that. It was a wonderful way to get around, wasn't it?
The best. And you know, if you were writing sports, you didn't have to think very hard or check many facts because there were none to check. No, you got the final score of a game, and after that, it was anybody's guess what you wanted to say and who cared and who knew.
Yeah, wonderful story. The one story where he had finished, I think he was covering the World Series. He had his portable typewriter, which he carried around with him. Guy at the stadium said, Mr. Runyon, can I check the... the typewriter for you. And Runyon says, I'd rather leave my prick. These are wonderful anecdotes. It's one after another after another. How in the world did you research a book?
I started in the newspaper business in the city of New York. I mean, I'd been to Long Island Press, but I began two places. One was the Scripps Howard Feature Service, where Harry Grayson was the sports editor, and he'd been a sort of enemy of Runyon's through all those years, so I had a lot of stories. They had fought over prize fighting only, nothing personal. And the second place I went to was the New York Journal American, which, of course, was where Runyon worked. And between the two places, I must have heard 1,000 stories about him, and I just retained them. I kept the stories I heard.
Up here?
Yeah, sure, some of them, you're not going to forget things you told about that. How they got Joe Louis. I mean, Runyon had all this talent, and he should have just stayed and looked at a bare wall and wrote these stories and on and tried a longer form, a novel, but instead he had the real dream. He wanted to find and own a heavyweight champion of the world. That was more important than anything to him. And he wound up with Joe Louis, having something to do with Joe Louis coming to New York, when the Madison Square Garden wouldn't allow a black to box on top in a championship fight, as they called. Runyon hired an outdoor ballpark and got a ticket broker named Mike Jacobs, a theater ticket broker, to put up some money. And they brought in Joe Louis from Detroit, Michigan, and he had him box Primo Carnera at Yankee Stadium. And Louis slaughtered him and went on to become a champion, and Runyon always had a little bit to do with that for a while, financial interest in him.
Should be noted that Canera also had an affair with Runyon.
Here was the key. If this is the thing about living in illusion, which is so great. He decided, did Damon Runyon, that he was the ultimate Broadway wise guy. He knew everything about the city. He knew the mayor, Jimmy Walker. Close friends, walked the streets together. He knew the great sayings, all horse players die broke. The race is not always to the swift nor to the smartest, whatever he'd say, but it helps to get there first. He had all these wise guy sayings, never knock a winner, you know, get the money, and knew everything. He didn't know that his wife would sit next to him at the bar and she's supposedly drinking only Coke, which he was quite proud of that she didn't drink, and she'd have a ton of gin in it and get stewed while she was sitting next to him. He thought she was just talking cute while she was slurring and babbling.
And he didn't know that she was going out with the Primo Carnera, who was about the biggest heavyweight anybody had ever seen. What was he, 6'6" or something? He was going out with Runyon's wife. He didn't. Runyon didn't even know that.
Well, while Patrice was drinking, and Runyon's first wife also drank and died prematurely at the age of 45, you point out. Mm-hmm. Runyon himself, outside of his Colorado days, did not turn out to be a drinker.
No, he went insane on whiskey in Colorado and stopped. And then he came to New York and he lived on coffee ever after until and cigarettes, which did him in quicker than any whiskey could, I guess.
Yeah, you describe him sitting at his typewriter with using the cigarette almost like a prop.
That's right. Well, it gets that way when you're writing. I knew that. It's part of your motion. Hit type to the end, hit the carriage, hit the cigarette, and start again typing. And that was his life.
Now, Runyon carried with him a cigarette lighter that came from a special person. Tell
Pancho,
me about that.
He went, this was his life. He went to Mexico, the type of life he led. He went to Mexico to cover the Mexican revolt led by Pancho Villa in the north, and Zapata was doing it in the south. Now, Villa was stationed at Juarez Racetrack because he liked horses and he was always in that area. And once in a while, the United States artillery from Fort Bliss would shell the place, shell the racetrack, and Villa would scream it was because they were losing their money, these rats. Villa was a great favorite of the Hearst newspapers for a long time, and then suddenly Pancho Villa went on to the estate of Mrs. William Randolph Hearst, which was located in Chihuahua, the state of Chihuahua in Mexico. She had huge land holdings, as did the Buckleys, William Buckley family. Everybody had great land holdings down there, and Villa thought, well, who the hell are these people who have these things? So Villa went in and took 600 head of cattle or so from the Hearst estate, at which time, out of New York, here came the Hearst papers. Villa is a threat to all of America and must be grabbed and placed in prison at least forever. Get Villa dead or alive. These are the editorials. Runyon was sent to cover the war. Well, the fighting, well, he got there before the shelling began in earnest, and the United States troops were on the move after Villa. He got there in time to go to the racetrack with him, talk to him, and Villa gave him a lighter, big lighter, jewels in it, big emerald in it, a magnificent heavy thing, and it says in Spanish, to my friend Damon Runyon from Pancho Villa. And he put that lighter in his pocket, and he used that all during the time as he's writing these stories, why the United States and General Pershing and Lieutenant Patton with his new machine gun mounted on a truck invention must get Villa, who's a threat to this country. Here he's lighting his cigarettes with Villa's lighter.
Now, is that actually true that he actually met Villa and got this lighter, or did he make it up?
Well, now, here's how we know he didn't make it up. Certain things I do. A man calls me from Roxy's Clothes when I started doing this book. Roxy's Clothes, Thayer Street, Providence, Rhode Island. One flight up from the street. It's a clothes store that many Brown University students go to, of all things. He said that at a sale in outside of Providence, he bought the remains of Mrs. Damon Runyon, the housekeeper, when she died a few years ago. And he just wanted me to see them if I were writing a book about Runyon. It might help. So I went up there, and there were shirts with Runyon's initials on the inside of the sleeve. D.R., it was only he, as long as he knew he had the shirt initial, that's all that counted. Or it was on the back of the collar, where you couldn't see it. As long as he knew it was initial, that was all right. You didn't have to see it. And then there were dresses that Patrice Amati Runyon wore. And then here was this lighter, great lighter. And I remember turning it over on the counter, and he just showed me, there it is, Pancho Villa. And it was the exact lighter that I'd heard about, and it's physically there.
Now,
and the writing, you can track his whereabouts in Texas at those times, from Marlin, Texas, to El Paso, to Juarez, and the dates, and it was there.
Now, his relationship with Hearst, Hearst called him into his home on a number of occasions, as you write in your biography, saying, I want you to do something for America. You can be in a position to help America.
Yeah.
One of the things, Hearst wanted to trumpet Pershing.
Mm.
And Runyon, of course, liked talking about everyday people.
Yeah.
When he went over to Europe, he wanted to write about the GIs. Mm. But Pershing wanted him to do more because Pershing was a big booster. I mean, sorry, Hearst wanted him to do more because Hearst was a
Hearst had a problem. Can I say?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hearst, William Randolph Hearst was a genius, but he made picks that leave you dizzy. He picked Germany in World War One at the start. He thought they were going to win, and his papers reflected that. Then he began the tide of battle turned, as did the Hearst editorial policy. He now said we must slay the Hun, destroy them, the Germans. And when America got into the war, it was get them. Runyon was in France writing about these things for the Hearst newspapers. And then the war ended, and now here come the troops home. One shipload is coming home, and it's coming to New York Harbor. And Hearst, with his political pull here, trying to save his name, had the mayor of the city name him, he Hearst, as the official welcoming home committee for all troops coming into New York Harbor. Now, he thought that was great. He'd be on the dock with his arms open to our dear soldiers. Everybody would say, Hearst the Patriot, and they'd forget he was for the Germans. On the ship, however, the troops mutinied when they heard this. Threatened the mutiny. They did not want Hearst to meet them, and they were going to sign a petition and a proclamation saying that he was un-American and that maybe others had forgot what he did, but they did not. Good. Hearing this, Hearst sends a note to Runyon, a cable to Runyon, telephone, cable, telephone, message. Now, they used those wireless. He used to send two wires, half the words in one wire, half the words in the other, so nobody could read what he was doing, Hearst. Runyon got these wires, and he went to see Pershing. He knew Pershing from the Mexican War chasing Villa. Pershing was the general in charge. So he said to Pershing that, that it would be embarrassing if the troops on the ship, the Patria, P-A-T-R-I-A, came into New York Harbor and insulted Hearst. It would be a little tough. So Pershing reminded Runyon that the officer in charge of the ship, the Patria, coming into New York Harbor was George S. Patton, who had been a lieutenant in Mexico while they were there. And Pershing said he didn't think it would be very hard to do something about it with a cable to the ship, which they sent. And on the ship, as it came into New York Harbor, Patton made a very famous speech about how to be a officer on the way up in the United States Army. He called all the officers into his room and he said, gentlemen, now, if Mr. Hearst is kind enough to want to come out and welcome us, the least we can do is respect his position and respect him for wanting to take part in this celebration and officially welcome us. And they still growled. So finally Patton said, gentlemen, may I remind you of one thing? I don't shoot at printing presses. And that is my position in this matter, and it's over. And there was no proclamation, and when the ship pulled up to the dock here in the pier on the North River, New York City, here was Hearst at the end of the pier with his arms open, welcoming home the boys from Europe.
Now, you say a lot about, you mentioned printing presses, you say a lot about the newspaper business during this period, and the old Park Row, which no longer exists. There's something like that. Did you say 16 newspapers?
Yep. All over the
public. But you also indicate, while it sounds romantic, having all those newspapers, I think you point out that a lot of them were pretty second-rate.
Oh, bad papers. Terrible. Disgraceful things. They were there. It was the only agency of information. There was no CBS All Day News. There was no Channels 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, it was just the newspapers and that's it. They had no radios even at this time. And you had, out of that, they were bad papers, but I think out of that they left this city something which it now has dissipated and has no longer. And that's an energy in the news that the people are delivered to the people. Words in a newspaper and on the air are a product of nervous energy. They're not a product of cool reflection in a corner someplace. their product written with noise and racket and smoke and people yelling at that time. They remember Irvin Cobb was a rewrite man on the New York World that worked with Runyon, and he was out on the street and somebody got shot, a fellow walking to his job. There'd been an argument, two other people were shooting. This guy got shot. Cobb went back to his office, and he sat there, and he was very nervous. They had eyewitness. Fellas in the newsroom wrote stories about it that lasted through the years. As they watched Cobb, he knew he had seen something special. He wanted to say it in a certain way. He kept making the typewriter jump up and down, and he kept rejecting the first thought, the second word he thought of, the third, and then finally he just wrote, an innocent bystander was shot today while he was walking down Broadway. It was the first time innocent bystander had ever been used, and it took its place instantly in the American language. Now, you do a thing like that, you've got to get a reward immediately. That's what the news business is all about, instant gratification. So he ran down to the bar. Right? Give me a great big beer and two shots with it, right? Now he had that, and he also had to have a loose woman right away. And the loose woman said to him, you know, Irvin, I just had a guy today, you should have seen him. She's at the bar telling him while he's swallowing and whiskey and beer. And she said, Irvin, he was such a stuffed shirt. He put down the glass, went back to the office, and wrote a piece in which he put stuffed shirt, and that went into the English language that day. It was two expressions, and one day, out of nerves and tumult. I submit to you, you don't get any of that out of quiet, well-groomed people out of the best schools sitting there and very knowledgeable about everything except how to excite people and how to get excited themselves over the news. I think the people today in the news business generally, in the newspapers particularly, I could speak for because they are the worst. They are so proper, they wouldn't deign to give of themselves, to open themselves up, to take in the experiences of someone else and feel them and get excited about it as they tell you about it. They wouldn't do that. No, they must look for the larger meaning to this, of course. They're not going to get excited. That's a grubby act. They'll coolly contemplate. That's the act of someone with a master's degree in political science and English who could speak two or three languages. That's what they're like. They're the most magnificently trained news force I've ever seen, and they're the worst at doing the one thing they're supposed to do, which is excite the public with a story. You had that, though. You had there's no bars today. There's no place where newspaper men stay in bars. Now, it's great for personal lives. It's great for the livers. People don't die. They're more responsible when they bring the rent money home a lot better than they used to. But there's no conversation about writing. Nobody said, did you see the lead sentence, so-and-so write it. Gee, that's a great thing. Like you wouldn't notice they say, Irvin Cobb just had this thing, innocent bystander, stuffed shirt, great, we got to match him. Or you would have a James M. Cain, was a rewrite man on one of those papers, and he just looked at them in the bar with disdain one day, and he said, how many of you here know why the postman always rings twice? And they said, I don't know why. He says, I don't know, a guy said. And Cain said, well, I know. And he put his glass down and walked out. He wrote a book called The Postman Always Rings Twice, which if you want to buy an old movie, it's still there. It's a classic. You had that style. You don't have that today. And I'm not talking like an old-timer because I write today, and my book is out today, and I'm part of today. But I know it's weak.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, although the energy that you spoke of is really associated with young people. Here at CBS, the best reporters are usually the young ones, the ones who are most excited about things. If I never have to cover another fire, I'll be happy. I mean, I used to cover fires and just fill in blanks, but it excites a 23-year-old, 24-year-old new reporter or stringer that we have. You know what I'm saying?
I don't believe you.
Well,
I don't believe you.
Maybe,
I mean, it's easy to say you did.
Maybe I've been in it 30 years. Maybe I'm just tired.
No, I don't think so. I think it's in the afternoon. We're going to start a full round of news on the desk, and you start thinking that way. I don't think so. You're not here. The daily surprises of being in the news business keep you going, keep you alive.
Well, trying to find new things. Having the chance to talk to
writers. That's the whole game. Talking to anyone, it's exciting. That's a great thing. What a business. You walk out and you meet somebody you never met before and talk to them And he wants to talk back. It's agreeable. What a way to make a living, my Lord. And the looking forward to that each day, I just think it, I had a flu in 1968, and I've never had another thing. I never missed another day since, except finally a tooth kicked up and I couldn't move about 3 weeks ago. But that 68, that 78, 88, what's that, 23, 24 years? Not a day for a cold, nothing. It's the surprises. Keep the blood boiling and the germs dying. I think it's great.
Well, Jimmy, we're almost out of time. We only have about five more minutes, but I just want to ask a few more questions about Damon Runyon.
Yes, sir.
He was really a vain man. I think you mentioned that he spent like an hour just getting dressed.
Just the tie would take an hour. He had the largest wardrobe anybody saw. Well, he came from nothing, and frequently as happens, I mean, he had really nothing when he was growing up, and then they want everything. And he was earning huge money for those days, huge money. I mean, just his Hearst contract alone was $25,000 a year in the 20s. It's
plus
movies.
He lost a lot of money, too. He was a gambler.
Oh, did he gamble, lose? Patrice, the wife, took everything from him in a divorce. But that wasn't the idea was he had a great amount of money coming in. He didn't keep it. But he had in 1 year, 1931, I think that's the height of the Depression. I think he had four movies in 1 year up here. That's a pretty good score.
He also went to Hollywood briefly.
To Hollywood, and he had a contract for $2,500 a week as a producer of movies at 20th Century Fox, while he was still doing the newspaper column. Oh, there were some good years in there, smashing years. And it was all based on the fact that on people who committed amiable crime. He loved illegitimate people. They were all gangsters and crapshooters and safe crackers. He didn't, no businessmen. We've glorified businessmen in the 80s. The feared stockbroker was the star of the magazine covers in 80, through 84, 85. I mean, it's nuts. Runyon would have a fellow like Harry Champ Siegel, who came out of the Siegel Safety Razor and Lock Company. They made a big lock, and Champ Siegel was a wayward member of the family, and they used to say that the family makes the lock and the champ picks them. And he had a bar up on Lenox Avenue, and outside the bar one night, two fellows were shot, and the detectives arrived, and there on the back bar in Siegel's place, inside the bar, was a big gun with the initials HS on it, and the gun reeked of cordite. So the detective took the gun and Siegel, and he gets him downtown for an arraignment, and Runyon shows up in the courtroom to watch the arraignment. Siegel just sneered and said, "Don't worry about this." And Siegel then told the judge, "I can prove I didn't shoot these two fellas." And the judge said, "How can you do that?" And Siegel said, "Because I don't own a gun." So they said, "What about this gun with the HS on it?" Siegel said, "I'm the only guy in the world with the initials HS. Do you know how many guys there are with the initials HS?" And he started yelling. And they let him out on bail. And when he got outside the court, he said to Runyon, Damon, let me ask you something. If I go back and I'm very nice to that guy, do you think he'll give me back my gun?" I mean, that's the type of fellas he had around at all times. Today we don't have those people because they're all in the narcotics business, drug business.
One thing about Damon, and that you point out in your biography, is that he had a very awkward relationship with his family, especially with his children. He was really estranged all of his life, wasn't he?
Yep, he didn't even go to his own daughter's wedding, and his own son began to drink. And at the end, no matter, he had the daughter away for 40 years in homes and in institutions because she drank a little. But at the end, she desperately in love with him and with his memory, live forever. You know, the worse you are to kids, I guess the better they are to you. They revered him to the end.
One of the most harrowing episodes in the book comes toward the end where he is dying. He had throat cancer.
Yes, from cigarettes. Caruso had used to swab his throat and spend 45 minutes with glycerines and steam, and then reach in his pocket and start smoking a half a pack of cigarettes. So Runyon thought, if it doesn't hurt Caruso's throat, it doesn't hurt mine. Well, it did. He got cancer, and at that time, the only thing they they thought throat cancer was a local disease, that you just cut it out and that would be the end of it. That's what they knew about cancer in 1946. They didn't know that it spread. Well, after several operations, it was clear it was spreading. And he died at Memorial Hospital, but he performed one act when he died. He and his family and these wise guys around them, that lasts forever. And that was, they announced that he died of cancer. And that made him the first person in this country with a known name. At that time, it was quite a famous name in 1946, Damon Runyon. It was synonymous with the city of New York, synonymous with wise guys, tough guys, smart remarks, racetracks, prize fighting. They announced to the world that he died of cancer. Prior to that, everybody who died of that disease, they always said he died of a lengthy illness, or she died after a long illness. And it was the people, when they caught cancer, were asked to suffer in agony and in shame and secrecy. They didn't want anybody to know. It's a disease nobody talked about. Runyon and his people, with that Broadway openness, that flippancy, just said, well, what was it, a common cold? He didn't die of a cold. He died of cancer. And after that, more people began to discuss this topic. It led to a lot of talk about people having cancer for the first time, and that's a great service.
Now, Runyon has been dead since 1946. Is he still being read?
I had to read him. I don't know. It's the best newspaper writing I read in a long, long time. I don't know how many of his paperback books out or how many
of the stories hold up for today's readers.
Oh, The Lemon Drop Kid does forever. Yeah. The one short story I know of will last for a long, long, long time. Yeah. I think, and for a lot of readers, most of them will, but the one just stood out to me so much. I don't know, The Guys and Dolls, the play will last forever. They're going to have revivals of that on Broadway. I think they have two companies rehearsing it now or something. Somebody told me to go on the road. I don't know. And that's it. But the times in which, the times he invented, Broadway and the Roaring Twenties, that lives forever, for real, in every history book there is.
He really was a man for his day, wasn't he?
Perfect. Perfect. Nothing was important. Make it up, and then make it come true. Live it. And the illusion will become reality and part of life. It was marvelous.
And he also had a way with the language. He knew the way people talked.
Yeah, well, he was able to listen. Very few people can listen. Very few news people listen at all. Some of our top columnists, if you've ever heard them, was they're interviewing and speaking with a politician or some government figure. They do all the talking. And you get the column the next day, and it's filled with their talk. No one listens. Runyon was a master at listening to people and getting how they spoke down in print.
I guess a runner-up to Runyon was Ring Lardner, who was very similar.
Ring Lardner had marvelous, I mean, it would appear to have been the more erudite of the two, and he would be more with the Connecticut and New Yorker set, and Runyon would be more with the crowds, except when you throw the movie thing in, then it's all over. 26 movies did help form people's opinion as to the lives around them, and that was Runyon. He knew that the American art form was the movie.
Now, Jeremy Brosnan, you spent a lot of time researching, writing this book. Mm-hmm. Just my last question is... What do you think? Do you like Runyon? What is your opinion about Runyon as a person?
Being in the same business, I have to admire the way he worked. If you're doing four columns a week and then writing a book, writing short stories, the changing over from a column about a prize fight to fiction, developing a character on your days off and your time off, I mean, it can have you crazy. Now, I do three columns a week for the New York Newsday, and I write these books, and it's torment. It's 7 days. Forget the labor involved. It's the changing from a newspaper column about, say, a woman from Utah whose son had been murdered in the subway, sitting on the witness stand yesterday and weeping as she told how she saw her dead son. Then you get up in the morning, as I did today, and sit down. I'm doing a novel, and I'm starting to work on a character, a little part of his character. It's torment. I had to admire him for doing that. I did not admire him for the manner in which he took care of his family. He ran away from them. Now, having had a father who walked out on me when I was age six, he went out to get a pack of cigarettes, and I never saw him again. I never much appreciated the way that he just walked out on the two kids and just didn't, most of the time, never saw them again. And I think it was taking advantage of the newspaper life. They would use that as an excuse. People like Runyon, Fowler, most of them were very poor family people. And I think that's an important trait in a human being. If you walk out on your kids, I kind of look at it and observe it. They would use the newspapers because that was the way they thought they were supposed to act. If you were on a newspaper, you were allowed to be a drunk, a gambler, a philanderer, and probably a drug addict, and also you were allowed to walk out if the wife was bothering you, the hell with it, leave her. And they would leave him one night, you know, just put the hat on the head and walk out. And that I don't quite identify with.
Jimmy Resnick, terrific book, A Life of Damon Runyon. Thank you very, very
much. Thank you.